TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Ward Churchill on the History of the FBI. On the 26th anniversary of the firefight on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the Native American professor, activist, and author Ward Churchill spoke in honor of Leonard Peltier. Peltier was sentenced for the murder on Pine Ridge of two FBI agents, a murder he and others say he did not commit. Ward Churchill explores the reasons why Leonard Peltier remains imprisoned today. Peltier was a member of AIM, the American Indian Movement, when he was arrested. He and other AIM members had been invited by traditional elders on Pine Ridge to protect them from death squads that had already taken the lives of 69 tribal members. The dispute on Pine Ridge centered on the transfer of 1/8 of the reservation land to the federal government. When uranium was found on the reservation, the federal government promised money to tribal president Dick Wilson in return for his okay of the land transfer. He used that money to build a private army, the so-called goon squads, who then murdered and intimidated the members of the Lakota land rights movement. The FBI had refused to investigate these murders and was openly supporting the goon squads. Ward Churchill describes the firefight on Pine Ridge in the context of the FBI's 90-year history of undermining social change organizations in the U.S. Last week, you heard about the 15,000 victims of the Palmer Raids, the destruction of the largest movement to date of African Americans, Marcus Garvey's United Negro Improvement Association, and the obliteration of the Communist Party. Ward Churchill actually makes the case that the FBI had to reconstitute the Communist Party in order to have a target during the Cold War. Today, Ward Churchill takes you to Mississippi at the time of the Civil Rights Movement. He begins by reminding us of the violent role of the Ku Klux Klan. Here is Ward Churchill.
Don't even know what the death toll was of civil rights campaigns at the hands of entities like the White Knights, the Ku Klux Klan in northern Mississippi. It was a very violent period. And a lot of that was organic. That is to say, the Klan was real. It emerged from the Jim Crow cracker structure of Southern social relations, political interests, economic interests, and all the rest. It's not the Klan was a fiction or an invention of the FBI. It's the nature of the social arrangement in the Gothic South of the period. But not exclusively so. One of the prime axe handle wielders against the Freedom Riders in 1961, Jackson, Mississippi, was a guy by the name of Gary Francis Rowe. Gary Francis Rowe had been on the payroll of the FBI to penetrate the Mississippi Klan. He'd gone into the Alabama Klan. He was there as an act of solidarity in Jackson that day. Okay? He was also active in Birmingham. He was one of the guys who was beating people into a puddle. Meanwhile, FBI agents stand there taking notes as their guy, their infiltrator, makes his bones, renders himself credible to his colleagues, but being one of the most violent members of one of the most violent clans of the Klan in the entire South. This is the guy who appears to have provided the dynamite to dynamite Bob Chambliss to do the 16th Street Church bombing in Birmingham. This was an FBI infiltrator. I think the key to the whole thing and understanding how that operation was working, however, comes with the Mississippi Freedom Summer activities in 1964 when the Cheney Schwerner Goodman murders occur. Now, mistake was made there in a certain strategic sense, because when the White Knights, the sheriff, Philadelphia, Mississippi, and his deputy, Cecil Price, nailed these three civil rights workers, they probably were not aware that Schwerner's parents were well-connected members of the Lyndon Johnson Democratic Party apparatus. And when their son disappeared in Mississippi, they simply called the White House and they said, "Mickey's missing. Do something, Lyndon." And Lyndon called Hoover immediately after hanging up the phone with him and said, "Eddie, get some people down there and find this kid." And Hoover said what he usually said: "Well, it's a matter of state right. We don't have jurisdiction. All we do is investigate. We're not law enforcement. We're really not, you know." And Real interesting. Things can get done when somebody decides to get done, and the FBI's ineffectuality in solving certain crimes is belied by this fact. Lyndon Johnson heard him out and said, "You got 24 hours or I'm going to have the Navy in there." And Hoover thought he was bluffing. And Johnson sent the Navy in. You got all these swabbies dragging swamps trying to find these guys that are missing. And it's embarrassing as hell to Hoover because it's essentially telling the public that the FBI, with all its vaunted investigative expertise, can't be relied upon to solve a simple triple homicide in Klan country in rural Mississippi against a bunch of hicks. So he saturates the area next with Klansmen, and he goes after the Klan, kind of like you see in Mississippi Burning, which is a grand distortion, but they actually did use counterintelligence techniques, hammer and tong, against the White Knights. Why? Because this actually was an autonomous Klan entity, and it was operating on its own set of principles autonomously from the government. It was not under control, and it had just embarrassed the FBI, and so its autonomy was destroyed. According to the guy who ran this whole operation, William Sullivan, in his memoirs, within 3 months, they'd obliterated the entire Klan leadership structure, had them up on charges, which they could have done at any time in the recent past had they decided to make it a priority. But this time, since it was a priority, they got it done. And they infiltrated the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan with people on their payroll to about 50th percentile. Half the membership were active FBI informants within 3 months, including individuals that he said are at the upper levels of decision making. In other words, they took charge. That was the nature of the COINTELPRO. The outcome that they desired was to take it over, denied its autonomy, so that it could only engage in violent functions against the civil rights movements that were approved, approved targets, and so forth. 50 pages later in his book, I don't know whether he didn't have a good editor in the basement of the Bureau or what, but Sullivan says, you know, between 1964 and 1969, the Mississippi Klan committed over 300 bombings of civil rights targets in Mississippi. Now let me see, if the FBI took over, as he says 50 pages earlier, the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in 1964, who actually carried out those 300 bombings? So you got a certain kind of bias that's built in. When you look at political repression, they're going to repress anybody that's upsetting their stability and their plans. And it really doesn't protect you to be a member of the Aryan Nation or the Aryan Brotherhood unless you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. But with right-wing organizations, the objective of an FBI counterintelligence operation is to put them under control, to use them as a counter in the counterintelligence operations they're conducting against those they really want to destroy. And those they really want to destroy happen to always be peoples of color and left-leaning organizations. And under left-leaning organizations, under that rubric, I'm placing anarchist organizations, although undoubtedly they'd resent the hell out of the implication of being leftists, okay? Out of that experience, civil rights movement transforms itself into first black power movement and then black liberation movement. And the emblematic formation of the black liberation movement is the Black Panther Party. That's fairly well understood. The Black Panther Party ultimately accounts for about, it's a fairly small organization for all of its notoriety. Ultimately, its peak, 5,000 members, is proclaimed by J. Edgar Hoover to be the number one internal security threat to the United States by 1968. It's not 5,000 members yet at that point. Actually, the publicists who put out that statement on behalf of Hoover probably furthered Panther recruitment because people say, hey, number one security threat to the U.S., I'm going to join, man. Yeah. So you got a lot of recruits to the Panthers out of that, but the other part that wasn't so funny was the FBI really set out to destroy them, and they meant literally. So you got 28 dead Panthers in a very short period of time. You got city-by-city raids. You got destruction, infiltration at an unprecedented level. Provocateurs functioning at an unprecedented level. You got the framing of individuals like Geronimo Pratt, Geronimo G. Jaga, as he's now known, Daruba Bin Wadhad, a number of other of those who are considered by the FBI to be key activists, key agitators is another term used. And one of the reasons they were so effective during the late 1960s with this kind of thing is because nobody believed that they would do it. It wouldn't happen here. Well, guess what? I'm giving you chapter and verse and the fact that it did. It did. It's happened here over and over and over again. Every time someone or some group begins to become effective galvanizing people. Ultimately, the most intensive of all these operations that were carried out was against the American Indian movement, because it had benefit, ultimately, of all the experience that was obtained during the 1960s against the civil rights movement, against the Klan, against the Puerto Ricanos, against everybody who was politically to the left of Attila the Hun, like I said. And the stakes that were involved in the issue, because ultimately you're talking about the territorial integrity of the United States when you talk about the decolonization of Native North America. It's not like the classic form of colonialism, like the French colonization of Algeria, where if decolonization is the nature of the struggle and the decolonization movement wins, well, the colonizers go home to France. If the decolonization struggle with respect to Native North America succeeds, where is it the colonizers are going to go? Yeah, you can see the magnitude of the issue. Hence, we go from counterintelligence to counterinsurgency, and rather than having 28 bodies in a couple of years, we end up with 69 that I can document, give a date of death to, and disposition of investigation on. Now, 69 bodies in the scale of things with regard to the violence that is exported on a daily basis by the United States may not sound like a lot, but let me frame it to you in another way. You got to deal with proportionality and scale. That's 69 people that were killed in a three-year period of time in a reservation area, the general population of which was 10,000 people at the time. Extrapolate that and you can make a comparison. That's a rate of death for political reasons virtually identical to that prevailed in Chile in the three-year aftermath of Pinochet's coup and overthrow of Salvador Allende. And that's generally considered to be a fascist reign of terror. Same exact set of circumstances, proportionally speaking, in the United States, although this is internal to the United States rather than external. The classic model of what operates in the third world is that the CIA presides over the enforcement apparatus of client regimes and organizes them into death squads, Mano Blanco or whatever. Okay, and they go out and do extra-legal eradication of political opposition to maintain order and stability for U.S. corporate investment purposes and profitability thereof. Well, here, since it's considered domestic, that is to say the colonies are held internally rather than neo-colonies out there in the third world, the active agency was the FBI, the client regime was the tribal government, the Wilson regime on Pine Ridge, the enforcement apparatus was the Bureau of Indian Affairs Police and an entity called the Goons, and they functioned as death squads, and this was the result. It's virtually interchangeable in terms of its form, despite the fact that the actors and the specific nature of the ingredients alter. By the time June 26th happened, you had over 40 fatalities, and due process, in effect, had been attempted. Each one of these had been reported to the relevant police officials and to the Justice Department. In several of these cases, you had multiple eyewitnesses. Every time you had eyewitness to the crimes, the murders that had occurred, the shooters or the killers, because it wasn't all by shooting, were identified as known members of what was called the Goon Squad, that is the Death Squad, that is the FBI-run mechanism of extra-legal enforcement on the reservation. There had been no prosecutions. There had been no indictments. There had been no serious investigations. So you have a situation that presented itself at that time. People had gotten the message. Either you stand down, you abandon your political resistance, you acquiesce in what it is that the authorities want to do with you, and that's to impound another eighth of the reservation at that point, because as we didn't know then, they discovered a uranium deposit on it, or you're going to have to provide for your own security, and that's what Northwest AIM Group, Peltier's formation of AIM, was doing in a jumping bull property at the time the FBI agents who were killed went there. And see, the FBI was undoubtedly frustrated as well. I mean, you got 40 fatalities in this closed environment. You got people who have been hammered. This is just the dead. During the same period of time, you got 342 really serious physical assaults that occur in that environment, almost exclusively directed at AIM members and supporters. So the level of violence is what the Assistant Attorney General of South Dakota, William Janklow, at the time called simply awesome. That's the reign of terror. Peltier and Northwest AIM Group were called to Oglala to defend a pair of elderly traditionals who were pursuing land rights of the Lakota at the time. They were targeted by these goon squads, and this was known. The FBI was frustrated because, despite sustaining this level of violence for a period of time, there was still the resistance. The movement's back wasn't broken, so they were looking to provoke an incident that would give them a pretext to bring in outright military force, as they had at Wounded Knee, but didn't really have a basis to do in the public mind just then. So they wanted to go there. They knew there was an AIM security group there. They expected to encounter 8 people when they got there. In the event, they actually encountered 30, but the 2 agents were assigned to go in and instigate a firefight. There was overwhelming force deployed in the immediate area. More than 250 SWAT-trained personnel just happened to be on hand. So once the firing started, they were supposed to move in real quick, and in fact, they did, but not quick enough. And when they discovered that there was more firepower down in the valley where the 2 agents were than they'd anticipated, they all lay down in a ditch and waited for people to leave. The agents were killed. Firing dropped off. Stunts was hit by a sniper. The Indians exited the scene. Every Indian there except Joe Stunts got away, despite you had this massive number of FBI personnel attempting to surround him, which should have made the FBI look foolish. Okay? Well, they had their incident. There's no indication that the FBI intended their personnel to be killed. Okay, they were simply to get the firefight going, but that's what happened. They were killed, and since they were killed, they used that to their advantage as well. When you got the FBI director, Clarence Kelly, convening a press conference shortly thereafter. In fact, the morning after, an FBI PR specialist, propaganda specialist, who had been imported simply to handle the press that were barred from the scene, held a press conference. Between the two, they managed to say that the agents were killed by a group of AIM members who lured them into a sophisticated bunker complex, executed them with automatic weapons, having first disabled them by gunfire, dragging them from their cars, stripping them of their clothes, riddled them with bullets, and in one account scalped them, nailed the scalps to a post, and took off. Well, the actuality was the agents claimed to be attempting to serve a warrant so they wouldn't have been lured. They were looking for a kid that they claimed was accused of kidnapping and aggravated assault, but was actually charged with the theft of a used pair of cowboy boots. It was utterly a pretext. You have 40 unsolved murders, but they're sending 2 agents chasing a teenager around the reservation over a pair of used cowboy boots. Okay. There were no bunkers. There were a couple of root cellars and tumble-down corrals, none of which had been used by firing pins, as the FBI's own personnel had discovered. They were in possession of the land by the time these statements were made, so they knew what was what. They knew each agent had been shot 3 times, which is not exactly riddled by automatic gunfire. In fact, they were pretty well aware that there had been no automatic weapons in possession of the Indians inside. Neither of the agents had been stripped, and neither of the agents had been scalped. It was from top to bottom a falsification designed to stimulate a public acceptance of what they were going to do next, and what they did next was send in overwhelming military force, 450 militarily equipped, using Huey helicopters, armored personnel carriers, wearing combat fatigues, and so on, agents to simply roll up the reservation. And at that point, they did manage to break the movement's resistance there. AIM withdrew because AIM had no capability of countering force at this level in toe-to-toe combat. And the rest, as they say, is history. Although they could identify all 30 of the people that were down there, they charged not a single individual from Pine Ridge with having participated in the firefight. What they wanted to do was drive a wedge between the traditional resistance on the reservation and those people who come in to provide assistance on request from the American Indian Movement. So they charged only 3 outsiders and ultimately took them to trial. That was Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler. Robidoux and Butler were apprehended first. Peltier had escaped into Canada. He was returned ultimately by the efforts of the RCMP, but at a date late enough that he was tried separately. At the first trial at Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the results are interesting, because all of what I've been talking about in terms of the context of what was going on in Pine Ridge was admitted by the judge in testimony. The jury heard it. The jury heard it confirmed by the director of the FBI himself, which on direct interrogation by William Kunstler couldn't deny it. And all the rhetoric about what AIM was about, he also acknowledged they had no evidentiary basis to make the allegations, and so he withdrew them. The jury heard that as well. The jury heard Bob Robidoux say, basically, I shot both the agents, wounding them mortally, and under these conditions I would do it again, and ultimately the jury agreed. The jury said, yes, any reasonable person confronted with this situation, these kinds of actions by the agents on a day immersed in the entire context, reign of terror, counterinsurgency, repression, mounted by the FBI, would have conducted themselves in the same way, protecting themselves from armed aggression and protecting non-combatant people who were living with them in a tent village on the security compound as well. Foreman of jury later said, I'd have blown their brains out. Okay? Also said they kept telling us that the AIM people were terrorists. They had all this security around. Ultimately, in the course of the trial, I realized I had much more to fear from the federal agents who were prowling the halls than from either of the men sitting at the table accused of murdering federal agents. Can be instructive, these trials. Okay, so they were acquitted on the basis of having acted reasonably in self-defense. Ipso facto, as they say in court, an all-white middle American jury in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, not exactly a hot spot of radical thought, okay, had determined that no murder had occurred. Neither of the agents were dead. They had not been murdered. Therefore, the FBI and the Justice Department charged Leonard Peltier with murder. Of course, that would be the obvious result. But in order to charge co-defendants, that is more than one person, and people other than Peltier at Cedar Rapids, they had to have a certain theory of the crime that was a group activity. But now they've only got one possible defendant left, so they got to have an entirely different theory of the crime. Yeah, they proceeded under a group conspiracy theory of how the agents died against Butler and Robidoux, but Peltier becomes a lone gunman. Now, I would submit to you that the prosecutor could have believed that there was a conspiracy to kill these agents. He would have been a dumb if he believed it, but he could have believed it. Or he could have believed that there was this lone gunman who was responsible for it, but it's the same prosecutor in the same case and the same set of facts, and he couldn't possibly believe both of those things. But he made both presentations against different defendants and ultimately was able to manipulate the evidentiary record to the point where they got Leonard Peltier. Okay? And in the process of getting Leonard Peltier, Lynn Crooks, the prosecutor, argued to the jury, in fact, more than argued, he acted out exactly how Peltier had cold-bloodedly, and I mean absolutely cold-bloodedly the way he portrayed it, executed both of these guys. He went so far as to explain to the jury what was in Peltier's mind as he did it and to present them with the last words of an agent just before he was shot. The emotionalism of the situation was so intense, apparently, no one in the jury ever got around to asking more than that. No one in the press ever got around to asking exactly how in hell Prosecutor Lynn Crooks could have known what the last words of the agent were, because the only two people present would have been the dead agent and the killer. So unless Lynn Crooks was the killer, this was a total fabrication. But there is no question on the basis of that presentation that he was accusing Leonard Peltier had been the principal, the shooter, the killer, the murderer. And a jury bought it and they convicted him. He was sentenced to boxcars. On appeal 8 years later, Lynn Crooks says, and I quote, "We really have no idea who shot the agents." That's what I meant at the outset when I said, not for anything that anybody, even his prosecutor, has been willing to say they believed he actually did at any point in the last 15 years. Nonetheless, he's still in prison. As a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous people within its claimed boundaries. And insofar as they can arbitrarily repress ours, they can, and in fact are, arbitrarily repressing yours as well. That's at the philosophical level of saying an injustice against one is an injustice against all, but given the nature of the history I've just laid out, their success presents a clear and present danger to the well-being of each and every individual in this room and everybody who didn't bother to show up as well. There's a converse to this, however. And that's what imbues this case with its cardinal importance. Obviously, they've got a major investiture of interest in making this symbol stick. In fact, it was useful to them when Crooks admitted that they could no longer sustain the evidentiary appearance that Peltier was guilty. The fact of his actual innocence punctuates the point of the arbitrariness of the penalty. What Peltier ultimately is considered guilty of is standing on his rights. And the message is, if you stand on your rights rather than pay lip service to it while acquiescing, we're going to make it cost you more than you're willing to pay to actually be a free person. You're an American. You're free, but free only in the sense to do exactly what you're told, and don't ever forget it. The converse is, to the extent that we could get Leonard Peltier out of prison, we send exactly the opposite signal, which is, no, you can't, and no, we won't. Leonard Peltier is not simply a symbol. He's a man. He is a human being. He's a human being who's been in prison for the last quarter century for standing on his rights, not for having engaged in anything which should have caused him to be where he is. By any reasonable standard, he should have been out of prison almost before he went in. by any reasonable standard, he should certainly come out now. And that's simply on the human basis of it. But the symbolic importance of Leonard Peltier to both sides of the equation greatly transcends the man, or adds to the imperative of getting him out in that sense. Leonard Peltier is a symbol thus both of repression in the ugliest form that it can come, and the symbol of liberation, which only we can achieve. We have a right to justice, just as Leonard Peltier has a right to justice. We have it as a human right, but we have it as something more. We have it as an obligation. Not only to ourselves do we owe success in this particular endeavor of freeing Leonard Peltier. We have the obligation for our coming generations, for our children and our children's children and our children's children's children, seven generations into the future. We have the obligation to pass along something better than that we've encountered. And this was one of the key ways we can be about it. I think we have a commonality of interest in it, and I welcome you to the struggle to that end. Mataquias.
You heard a history of COINTELPRO and the FBI by the Native American scholar, activist, and author Ward Churchill. Ward Churchill is professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also a Vietnam veteran and himself a survivor of the 1970s American Indian Movement. His many highly acclaimed books include The COINTELPRO Papers, Indians Are Us, and A Little Matter of Genocide. This was the second half of a one-hour history of the FBI with Ward Churchill, recorded on the 26th anniversary of the firefight on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. That took place on June 26th, 1975. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on this program on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a copy of the full one-hour history of the FBI with Ward Churchill for $12. That includes shipping. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Glarden. Thank you for listening.